you have any questions for Politics and Science, you can direct them by email to politicsandscience@madriver.com. That's politicsandscience@madriver.com. Politics and Science can be heard weekly on WMRW LP Warren 95.1 FM, airing on Mondays at 5 p.m. And in the Bellows Falls area, can be heard on Wool LP Bellows Falls at 101.1 FM, airing from 3 to 4 p.m. on Sundays and from 9 to 10 a.m. on Mondays. Politics and Science presents the viewpoints of its participants and does not necessarily reflect the viewpoints of any other person or organization.
It's wonderful, it's wonderful, it's wonderful. Good luck, my baby, it's wonderful, it's wonderful, it's wonderful. I dream of you, chips, chips. Da-dee-doo-dee-doo, chee-boom, chee-boom-boom. Da-dee-doo-dee-doo, chee-boom, chee-boom-boom. Da-dee-doo-dee-doo. Vieni via con me.
Hey, buongiorno. This is John Barkhausen, and I'm starting our show today, Politics and Science, with my special guest, Dr. Janet Sherman, who's a toxicologist living down in Virginia at this point. And Dr. Sherman, can you hear me?
Almost.
Not very well. I can adjust things here a little bit, perhaps. So Dr. Sherman is a toxicologist. He's also the author of Life's Delicate Balance, Causes and Prevention of Breast Cancer and Chemical Exposure and Disease. Dr. Sherman is a specialist in internal medicine and toxicology. She's published more than 70 articles in the scientific literature and also writes for the popular press to provide information to the public. And this is a very long resume you have here, very impressive, and you've obviously worked for the government and also in private practice. You're also translating and editing the book Chernobyl, Consequences of the Catastrophe for People and Nature.
Well, actually, I edited the book. I did not translate it. It came to me machine translated.
I see.
Machine program translated, and I edited it.
Oh, yeah.
And it's to be out, I hope, quite soon on Chernobyl.
Excellent. And today we're going to be talking to Dr. Sherman about radiation and its toxicological effects. First of all, maybe we can talk a little bit about your past experience, how you got interested in radiation in the first place, and what brought you to your present work.
Well, back in the dark ages, probably before most of your listeners have even been born, I worked for the Atomic Energy Commission at the University of California in the 1950s, and then after that worked for the Navy Radiation Lab, where we studied the effects of atomic radiation on animals. And after that experience, when I had to make a decision on what to do for more education, I decided I didn't want to do experiments on any more animals, and so went to medical school. And I've stayed interested in the whole radiation field since the 1950s.
So you went to medical school and became a general practitioner?
No, I'm a special internal medicine specialist. I went to medical school in Detroit, Michigan, and have maintained my interest in the effects of radiation and also toxic chemicals on people, how we can prevent illness by, I hope, educating people as the effects of toxic chemicals, pharmaceuticals, pesticides, and nuclear radiation to prevent illness.
Now, I should know what a specialist in internal medicine does, but perhaps I don't, so perhaps you can explain it to me.
Well, my associate was asked once, what does an internist, what covers the internal medicine? And he said, skin and contents. We are essentially people who do not do surgery, but are, you know, do a diagnosis of people, you know, skin and contents. Everything that's inside.
Well, that pretty much covers everything, doesn't it?
Pretty much does, yes.
So you're qualified to give your opinion on just about every subject.
Well, I don't know if that's true, but we've had, you know, interns have a lot of training in neurology, heart diseases, lung diseases, you know, whatever the non-surgical aspects of medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's something surgical, then we turn it over to colleagues to actually treat it.
Well, let's talk about the... you've studied a lot about the effects of radiation and other chemical pollutants. And I thought your book, Life's Delicate Balance, did a great job of explaining radiation to me, the different types of radiation. Some of it's in the form of wavelengths and others in the form of particles that emit radioactive waves. Is that right? And maybe you could give us an explanation, sort of recap what the book says.
Well, all energy, you know, occurs, whether it's sunlight or radio waves or nuclear radiation, you know, has different wavelengths.
Mm-hmm.
And different energies, and some is more powerful than others. We know, for instance, that X-rays will penetrate the entire body and can show you broken bones or lung diseases. We know that alpha radiation, which is actually a heavy hydrogen helium particle, has a bigger mass. It doesn't travel very far and actually can't even penetrate a piece of paper. But if it's inhaled into the body, the large size of this mass can cause significant damage as it decays. Beta particles are smaller, and they can go through as many as 30 or 40 cells as they do damage as they're passing through.
Hmm.
So you have alpha, beta, and gamma has the same penetrating power as X-rays.
I see. So maybe you could give us an example of some of the sources of those different particles and waves.
Well, the biggest concern from nuclear power plants are the 100 to 200 isotopes that are given off 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, as these nuclear power plants operate. Now, some of the particles that are given off have very short half-lives, but some have long half-lives, and something like strontium-90 has a half-life of, say, 28 years. And if these fall onto the soil, taken up by plants, taken up by, for instance, dairy cattle, and transferred into the milk, when a person drinks milk, they get a certain amount of the strontium-90. Now, strontium is like the same family as calcium, so it travels to the teeth and bones. And as it's, particularly if it's deposited in the teeth and bones of the unborn child or a young child, it can cause damage there. Now, that's a beta particle, and that decays with a significant amount of energy and can damage the bone marrow. Now, for instance, when Chernobyl exploded, there was an enormous amount of alpha-containing materials like plutonium. And that, when it's taken up in the body, particularly breathed in, can cause damage to the particularly to the lungs and other parts of the body where those particles go.
That's from nuclear power plants, and you say they're emitting these all the time.
Yes.
I mean, from the information I get from the news, I think given by the publicity departments of the nuclear power companies, they say their emissions are very low, and usually when you hear about it, you hear about their gamma radiation right around the facility. Like, for instance, the Vermont Yankee plant in southern Vermont, which actually has a school right across the street from it, has some gamma radiation. But I don't usually hear about the particulate, the alpha and the beta. But you think that's being released steadily anyway?
Oh, yes. Every nuclear power plant is releasing continually these isotopes. Now, the gamma is, you know, that's like an X-ray.
Mm-hmm.
The level of power of gamma rays decreases the further you get away from it. In other words, if you're 10 feet, it's at, you know, a certain amount of power, but if it's 20 feet, then it's actually a fourth of the power. So
mm-hmm.
although there is there is harm from gamma radiation, the biggest harm comes from the alpha and beta, because those are internalized. you understand that the gamma is external and they're damaging, but not as bad as when you get the alpha or the beta that's inhaled or ingested, goes to various parts of the body. That's the more dangerous, and that's the one that they say it's low levels. Well, yes, it's low levels, but it's continual.
Mm-hmm.
And if the half-life is 28 to 30 years, as it is for strontium-90 and cesium-137, then you, after a while you accumulate quite a bit of it. And it becomes a significant dose, particularly to children.
So if you have one of those particles, if you've ingested one, what exactly... it sounds like it has a charge that just keeps on giving off an electrical charge inside your body.
As each isotope decays, in other words, breaks down, it gives off energy. And as strontium-90 decays, it gives off a beta particle. Plutonium and other alpha emitters give off an alpha particle. And these, as they decay, cause harm as the energy is released from each of these isotopes and then causes damage to the cells.
And why do the cells... can you explain a little bit how cell function works and why these things are causing damage?
Well, we stay alive by our cells repairing themselves as we get certain damage to our cells, either from chemicals we eat or injuries we may have or radiation. We hopefully repair our cells, our skin cells, the cells that line our intestinal tract, our bladder cells, things like that. But if you get damaged from the nuclear radiation, you may damage the repair process of the cell. And if you kill a cell, then it's gone. But if you damage a cell, and particularly damage the repair process, you can wind up with a malignancy. And that's the biggest concern about why we're concerned about nuclear power plants.
Hmm. One of the things that struck me about all of this research that's been done, it's on Dr. Sternglass has done it, and it sounds like you've done quite a bit yourself, and Dr. Gould, was that his proper title?
Dr. Gould and then Mr. Mangano, yes. And we've done a lot of research on the effects around nuclear power plants.
And I guess some of that research was also on the bomb testing fallout, which was horrendous and went everywhere. And one of the things that struck me is that mostly you're talking about cancers, but there must be a lot of disease that happens previous to the cancer actually appearing. There must be a lot of, I think you even mentioned it, immune function that's damaged, and there's probably a lot of diseases that could be attributed to the damage done by radiation that's not actually being officially attributed to it.
Oh, you're absolutely correct. One of the pioneers in this field was Dr. John Goffman, who sadly died just 2 years ago this month. But he did the pioneering studies on the effects on the heart, and the that system due to exposure to X-rays. X-rays, and nuclear radiation. So the study that's coming out on, the book that's coming out, actually, on Chernobyl, should be out this fall soon, has shown not just there's adverse effects upon causing cancer, but also effects on the lining of the arteries and veins, particularly the arteries, causing damage to that, hypertension, arteriosclerosis, heart damage, also damage to the brain and nervous system, and then, as you mentioned, a damage to the immune system.
So that could account for an incredible amount of suffering.
Oh, an enormous amount of illness. I mean, we're not the healthy country that we were, say, many years ago. I mean, we have many more sick people these days than we had in the past. A percentage of our population mm-hmm. is not well, as I think, as a result of exposure not only to nuclear radiation but toxic chemicals.
One of the things that I think Dr. Sternglass mentioned, or it could have been Joe Mangano, was that thyroid cancer greatly increased. I think it was due to nuclear bomb testing fallout. And that indicated to me that, you know, so I think it was, you could attribute up to 250,000 cases of thyroid cancer to the fallout, I think is what the figure was, but I could be wrong. But that indicated there's probably a huge number of people who have low thyroid or who are hypothyroid because of damage. They don't have cancer, but they're not operating correctly.
You're right. People with damaged thyroids who have hypothyroidism, yes, many people are not well and don't know why they're not well, don't feel good, have no energy. Yes, this is one of the links. Mr. Mangano also did a very, very important study using data that's available online from the state of Pennsylvania. And he showed, using, as I say, this public data, that the highest thyroid cancer rate among blacks, whites, men, and women occurs in, no big guess, eastern Pennsylvania, all of which the counties are downwind from nuclear power plants, the Peach Bottom, the Limerick, the Susquehanna, and the Three Mile Island nuclear power plants. I mean, it's absolutely hard data that you can't argue with, and it's produced by the you know, the government.
And so, and yet all we hear, and I think we'll talk about this more in a minute, but all we hear from, you know, from the media, and I've been reading letters to the editor about Vermont Yankee, because there's a debate going on here in Vermont.
Can you talk a little louder, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. I've been hearing reading letters to the editor about Vermont Yankee, because there's a debate going on here in Vermont, because the legislature, if they don't vote to relicense Vermont Yankee for another 20 years... Vermont Yankee will have to shut down. And the arguments,
I think it should shut down. It's been operating since 1972.
It has come to the end of its original foreseen lifespan.
Yes.
But these letters I read basically say that, you know, nuclear power is safe and that nobody's ever been harmed by a nuclear power plant except experimental reactors, and that the Three Mile Island, that nobody died at Three Mile Island. So that's the range of different opinions we're having. We have on one side doctors and scientists like you saying that, and then there's also doctors and scientists on the other side saying that nobody's ever been harmed. And I think we need to go into that further. But before we do that, I'm sorry to be a little bit out of order here. I would like to talk about the different radiations. We've been talking about nuclear power radiation and the alpha, beta, and gamma from those plants. Is it the same as the bomb tests and the same as background radiation?
Well, no. Background radiation we've been living with for eons. You know, it goes back to the formation of the Earth. I mean, there is a certain amount of background radiation from rocks and from the sun.
Mm-hmm.
But we've lived that with that for, you know, eons. And it probably accounts for the slow amount of genetic variability that's occurred over the millennia. And that's kind of a given. I mean, that's there all the time. What we've done since the bomb tests have started, we've added an enormous amount of radiation to what I call the base load.
Can you explain that?
Well, you know, there is a certain amount of radiation that occurs from rocks, and mm-hmm. as I say, from the sun. But if you start exploding atomic bombs, and then you start building nuclear power plants, then you enormously increase the level of radiation to which humans, plants, animals, you know, everything is exposed. For instance, strontium-90 existed nowhere on Earth until the first nuclear bomb test at Alamogordo. And then, of course, more was released at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. When a bomb goes off, there is an enormous amount of power that's released. And most of the people died from thermal burns, blast radiation, this sort of thing. There was a certain amount of fallout of the isotopes. Unfortunately, our U.S. government didn't start studying it for 4 years until, you know, the weakest of the people died. And the data are not particularly robust. If you start looking at around, for instance, around what happened around Chernobyl, I mean, it was in every single system that was studied, every single one, whether it was humans, foxes, fish, trees, bacteria, viruses, no matter what was studied by the people who reported these various scientific studies around Chernobyl for the past 23 years, every single system was changed without exception. Every single system that was studied was altered because of the radiation from Chernobyl. Trees, everything.
The reason I asked you about the background radiation was that I've read the argument that Vermont Yankee admits no more radiation than you naturally find in any excavation along Route 89 where they dug to build the interstate from the naturally occurring uranium. I guess there's on average in New England a pound of uranium per acre. What's the difference between just the naturally occurring uranium and the isotopes you're talking about that come from nuclear technology?
Well, uranium has a regular breakdown series as it breaks down ultimately to lead, mostly releasing alpha and beta. But a nuclear power plant produces many, many brand new isotopes that never existed anywhere in nature, particularly strontium-90 and cesium-137. Now, these are particularly dangerous. Cesium-137 goes to all soft tissues. And it's the uranium, unless you're handling it or grinding it up and inhaling it, is relatively low energy. But when you're inhaling and ingesting short isotopes such as strontium-90, cesium-137, I-131, those do an enormous amount of damage.
So that's a false comparison.
Absolutely.
See.
I mean, people are telling you that nobody was harmed, it's absolutely not true. There was an increase in death rate in the counties downwind from Three Mile Island. Work by Dr. Steve Wing that was done after the government said, well, there's no problem, showed very clearly that there was a problem, and not only in humans, but also in farm animals that lived in the downwind from the plant.
So, and do you have any idea how many people were harmed at Three Mile Island?
I can't tell you off the top of my head, but it was, you know, a significant number of people. I can't tell you off the top of my head without looking it up.
Yeah. It's in your book, and we're talking to Dr. Janet Sherman, author of the book Life's Delicate Balance, which is an excellent book about the effects of radiation and other chemical pollutants on your health, and particularly I think the emphasis is on breast cancer, is that correct?
Well, the book was written particularly for breast cancer, but everything that causes breast cancer also causes testicular cancer and prostatic cancer, and also cancer in children. So although I aimed it at breast cancer, it includes all the other sensitive tissues as well.
Mm. Now, doctors sometimes compare the gamma radiation from medical x-rays, like in dental x-rays. Like I was told that a bone scan is like spending 2 hours in the sun. Can you respond to that? Is that an accurate statement?
Well, the sun is you're getting radiant energy from the sun, which may tan your skin and also may cause you skin cancer if you're one of those sensitive to it. But you're talking about, if you're talking about dental x-rays, I recommend that people do not have routine dental x-rays unless they've got, unless they're having a specific dental procedure such as a root canal or a significant filling, because every single x-ray exposure is cumulative. Now, the National Cancer Institute has come out and said, yes, National Cancer Institute and the National Academy of Sciences have both come out and said that, you know, radiation exposure is cumulative, and there is no dose that we know of lower than that causes no harm. So you want to minimize as much as possible your exposure to x-rays, medical x-rays. If it's absolutely necessary to diagnose a broken bone or some significant medical problem, then they're justified. But to use them for routine screening, I think is very harmful.
Mm-hmm.
And there's now considerable discussion on the whole idea of CT scans, particularly for children.
Yeah, there was an article in Newsweek maybe a year ago that I saw where they basically were saying they were overused, the CAT scans.
Oh, absolutely. CAT scans are way overused. And in many cases, they can be replaced by an MRI, which obviously costs more, but it doesn't give a radiation dose, particularly to a child.
Mm. And what do you think about bone scans?
If a person has decided that they're going to take the drugs, you know, like Fosamax or those other similar drugs, then they can go ahead and have a bone scan. But if a person has made a decision they're not going to take those drugs, then there's no point in getting a bone scan because, you know, most of us as we get older certainly do have some loss of bone. I mean, this is part of the aging process. And there's no point in getting a bone scan if you're not going to take the drugs.
And why do you need the bone scan if you take the drugs?
Well, I guess it's just to see if, you know, if there's any improvement with taking these drugs. You may have guessed from my answer that I have a questionable take on whether these drugs are that useful at all.
Mm.
And they certainly can cause a lot of harm, particularly dental problems occurring.
On the subject of medical x-rays, I also have spoken to Dr. Samuel Epstein, and he's fairly adamant that mammograms, which are often prescribed to a lot of people I know, he thinks those are quite harmful, and that there are other manual techniques for locating lumps, breast lumps, that are just as effective, or even more effective.
Well, I completely agree with him, and I wrote this up in my book, Life's Delicate Balance, that yes, you don't need to have x-ray mammograms. Ultrasound is effective. Thermograms, which are available in many countries and in some countries, in some areas in the United States, can be done just as well. And then careful self-examination or examination by your physician to just keep track of breast tissue density. You know, any woman, I recommend all women to check their own breasts at least once a month after they've had their menses, and just keep track of if there are any abnormalities or their tissue feels a little bit different. Certainly, thermograms and ultrasound can delineate any masses. Dr. Goffman clearly showed that with every single x-ray mammogram, there's an increased risk of breast cancer. So, you know, this is not the safest technique there is.
So the diagnosing technique is actually causing the disease it's trying to diagnose.
Some of the cancers, yes, sir.
Wow. Yeah, that seems a little self-defeating, doesn't it?
Yes. I talk to some women who've had, you know, breast cancer, and they say, oh, but my doctor's really keeping track of things now. I get a mammogram every 6 months. Well, that's not a good idea.
Hmm. Yeah. Now,
well, for instance, in my book, if you're, you know, you can increase, it increases the risk of breast cancer for every exams that, the many exams that a woman has to check for breast cancer.
And the book is Life's Delicate Balance, and we're talking to Dr. Jeanette Sherman, and who's an internist, and it sounds like a good one, too, I must say.
I try.
Now, sticking to the medical subject, usually it seems to be the common, what do you call it, the blame for cancer is usually placed on the victim. That it's a genetic fault that the victim has. They have a weak gene from an ancestor, and somehow that just seems to me that it's discounting pollution. Basically, it's discounting all the environmental causes that can actually affect the cells in your body. And what do you think of that genetic emphasis that we usually hear from the media? And where do you think it comes from?
Well, I think you're absolutely correct. I mean, it's blame the victim and take the heat off the polluting industries, you know, such as pesticides and toxic chemicals and some pharmaceuticals and nuclear radiation. Take the heat off them. Blame it on the victim. I mean, do you think the bicycle, oh, dear me, I'm trying to think of his name, the Lance Armstrong.
Ah.
Do you think that he didn't get enough exercise, that that's why he got testicular cancer? I don't think so.
Yeah.
I mean, we blame people for their own diseases when there are clearly, if you lived next to a toxic dump site, live next to a chemical plant that's giving off toxic chemicals or a nuclear power reactor, then your chances of getting cancer are increased. And if you are like a four-year-old child and get leukemia, is this because you smoked and drank? I don't think so. We know, for instance, that the beluga whales in the St. Lawrence River have a high rate of breast cancer. I don't think those animals smoke and drink and have faulty habits. We know that the St. Lawrence River is loaded with toxic chemicals and, you know, nuclear radiation from all the nuclear plants that are around the Great Lakes and empty out through the St. Lawrence River. Now, we also know that many of these chemicals damage the DNA and cause these genetic changes.
So the emphasis we hear from the news media that everything is genes are responsible for everything. Where do you think that came from?
Well, I think it's an attempt to take the emphasis away from the polluting industries, and or also, I mean, I don't credit our population with a high degree of scientific knowledge. I mean, if people are buying this idea that any of this new health legislation is going to, you know, require that grandma be killed, I think that our population is not very scientifically educated if they think some of these things are true.
Oh, I see. That's what they're saying the new health legislation will do.
Yes.
I see.
this is not, A, it's not true, and people are believing this because they're not very well educated as to science.
I hadn't heard that yet, but that's the classic scare tactic, I guess.
Yes, yes.
Right.
Well, and if you can blame somebody for faulty habits, that why they got cancer, then you can take the onus off the toxic dump site or the chemical plant or the nuclear plant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes sense, and it's so. Are there scientists that are putting that? I mean, the genes, genetic theory is always in the news, is and you know, decoding the DNA always makes big headlines. And I feel that all reinforces that same attitude. And you had an interesting section in your book about explaining DNA and how complicated it is. I wonder if you could just sum that up and maybe talk about what chemical pollutants do to DNA.
Well, they change the DNA, and it can be changed by radiation or by toxic chemicals. And once it's changed, it doesn't go. And if the repair mechanism has been changed, it doesn't go back to normal. And there, you have to realize there's an enormous amount of money to be made in these DNA testing, these genetic testing. I mean, they are not cheap. And if you can pour millions of dollars into genetic testing, then you don't put those millions of dollars into prevention. There's practically no money in prevention. It's just... nobody. If you recommend people take aspirin because it has been shown to decrease the incidence of colon cancer, nobody's going to give you a grant because aspirin's cheap.
Yeah.
But if you come up with some genetic test, then there's a lot of money to be made.
Yeah, let's talk about that. You say in your on your website, it says, Dr. Sherman's primary interest is the prevention of illness through public education and patient awareness. Now, some example like that you just gave of aspirin. It's a very common substance. It's not patentable. And yet aspirin is always being degraded in the news. It's they always tell you it causes ulcers.
Well, it does in some people. I mean, it's true. Not everybody can take aspirin, but most people can. And it's inexpensive, and it's a very effective drug for people with arthritis and, life-threatening pain.
Mm.
It's a very, very, it's been, you know, hundreds of years people have known about, you know, acetyl salicylic acid originally was discovered in the willow trees.
That's right. It's as old as the hills.
Yes.
So when you're doing these studies on the radiation effects downwind of nuclear power plants, I was noticing in your book that many times, I think it was Columbia University did a study and the National Cancer Institute was doing studies, and they failed to actually take into account, they were doing studies of breast cancer occurrences, and they failed to take into account the possibility of radiation of being involved. And
that was the Long Island breast cancer study, yes.
Yeah, and is that common for... I'd like you to talk about that study, but first I'd like to know, is that common for the National Cancer Institute to actually rule out an entire category of causation?
Unfortunately, I'm sorry to say yes. The National Cancer Institute spends very, very, very small amount of its budget on any kind of prevention activities. And there were people on Long Island, there were breast cancer advocates on Long Island who wrote to the NCI asking, pleading to look at the nuclear issue on Long Island because it's significant. And the when the study came out, they did not look at it at all. Not only did they not look at the radiation issue, they also did not look at the most common pesticides that could be linked to breast cancer. They only looked at the ones that had been more or less taken out of use so that no corporation would be upset with the results.
That's a little hard to believe because these are the regulators that are we've entrusted with looking out for our public health.
Well, we can't trust them. I mean, we simply cannot because they are amenable to pressure from corporate and industrial groups, the same as everybody. They have to be very careful.
Hmm. Now, you've been speaking out quite a bit about industrial pollution, and these industries all have money and think tanks and power in Washington. And have you personally encountered any pressure to not rock the boat, so to speak?
Well, yes, I have.
Can you talk about it a little bit?
Well, I can bring up one of the things. My book itself was selling in its third printing. My book, Lifestyle Like a Balance, was selling in its third printing and selling very well. And I received a call from the publisher, and they took it out of print.
And did he have...
And I have no proof. So this is, you know, subjective on my thought, my idea, as well as other people who knew about my book. I have no proof, but I did criticize the nuclear industry, the pharmaceutical industry, pesticide and chemical industry. I have no proof that they put pressure on the publisher to take my book out of print, but my book was taken out of print when it was selling very well in its third printing. I had to pay to get it back. And I'm the sole source right now of my book. So if people want copies of my book, they have to go to my website to get it.
And your website is?
It's www.Janet, spelled J-A-N-E-T-T-E, Sherman's, S-H-E-R-M-A-N.com. It's the old-fashioned spelling of Janet, www.JanetSherman.com.
All right. Well, I have to personally attest that what I've read of the book is excellent, and there's a lot of good explanations of the science of radiation and other pollution for the lay person like myself. So I think
it was written for the lay public, not for the scientific public.
And it has a lot of history in it too. So it gives you, it puts it all in context, which is very nice.
Thank you.
So you've had your book stopped. Has anything else happened in your career? You've been working in the field for a long time.
Yes, I've been harassed by certain chemical companies, and I won't mention them on the air, but I've been harassed by certain chemical companies on testimony I gave in regard to some toxic pesticides.
Mm-hmm. And you must obviously have a lot of colleagues after such a long career. And I know Joe Mangano of the, what's the name of his group? I forget the name of it right now.
The Radiation and Public Health.
Thank you. Yeah, radiation.org. And he's said that as soon as they come out with any kind of study or report, a lot of public officials, public health officials, are usually brought in to condemn the report and criticize it and basically... claim that it isn't accurate. And these public officials, health officials, are all in charge of the public health, and it seems like many of these reports from these nonprofit organizations are actually quite accurate. They seem accurate. They make sense when you look at the data they've collected and the way they present it. And how is it that, you know, well-meaning people who have been trained in public health can come out and basically, what would you call it, sabotage an effort to actually make things better?
Well, who's paying their salary?
The state is paying their salary.
The state of X is paying their salary.
Yeah.
They probably want to keep their job. That's part of it. For instance, in the state of Michigan in the 70s, there was an enormous release of polybrominated biphenyls that got into the food supply and contaminated hundreds of farms in Michigan and contaminated milk and food. The state came out and said, "Well, we really haven't seen any problems, and you know, don't worry about a thing." And then it turned out that when they finally did some samples in both the lower peninsula of Michigan and the upper peninsula of Michigan, there was a statistically significant difference in PBB levels in, you know, women, particularly in breast milk in the two areas, and found out that it was PBB was connected with cancer.
Hmm.
So, but this, you know, initially the state said, well, don't worry about a thing, which of course turned out to be not true at all. I mean, this gets repeated over and over, you know, across the country. You have to say, ask who's paying the salaries and who's calling the shots.
So you're saying follow the money, and in this case,
exactly.
So you're saying a public health official will probably be forced to knuckle under to industry because the industry is leaning on their department heads.
Well, department heads are just leaning on or is big contributor to the election of people from the state. Now, nobody has to buckle up. I mean, buckle down.
Mm-hmm.
You can say no, and you can quit your job, as the woman did at the Food and Drug Administration. I can't remember her name, but she was told that she could not do anything about this Plan B medication that under Bush they said, well, they had to study it some more, and she finally said, I quit. Now nobody is holding a gun to any public health official. They have the choice. If they don't want to go along with policies that they know to be, you know, wrong or unscientific, they don't have to stay in their jobs.
One of the things I found, which you reminded me of, and I found it in your book about Three Mile Island, but it had to do with some people who felt they had gotten cancer, I think, from Three Mile Island,
mm-hmm.
brought a claim against, actually I'm not sure, they're probably suing the nuclear power plant, I imagine. Oh, and the judge said here, I found it, that at the time of the accident, this is a quote, these plaintiffs were certainly aware of the release of radiation and threatened harm from such a release. They also knew, or should have known, that exposure to a radiation could cause adverse effects, and so they dismissed the charges against Metropolitan Edison. And isn't that kind of amazing? Because they basically said there was no harm done, and then
yes, and I know it's a catch-22. If you know that there's going to be harm and you're harmed, then you can't sue. And if you don't know that it's going to be harm and you're harmed,
yeah,
you still can't sue. I mean, it was, they had no, I mean, they just were up against it. They weren't going to. The legal system was really cast against anybody making a claim.
Now, also in your book, you have documents of other nuclear facilities where the same thing basically happened. People downwind of the Atomic Energy Commission's, is that the agency? I think they were military establishments, possibly. Rocky Flats was one of them. Hanford was another.
Hanford, yes.
Hanford, thank you. Now, those aren't nuclear power plants, or do they have reactors? So it's basically the same problem.
Well, Hanford is probably the most contaminated area in the continental United States. And that's where they did the production of the plutonium for the second atomic bomb that was dropped on Nagasaki. It's questionable whether the Hanford site, which is in eastern state of Washington, will ever be cleaned up, will ever be able to clean it up. I've talked to people who work with the native population up there, and they've walked along the Columbia River with a Geiger counter and said some of the berries are radioactive.
Wow.
A question whether it'll ever be cleaned up. I don't know. We've poured billions and billions and billions of dollars, of taxpayer dollars, into corporations who are trying to contain and clean up the radioactivity up there. I don't know if it'll ever be possible.
Well, how do you clean up something that has a half-life of 24,000 years? Or
you don't. No way to clean it up.
Yeah, that's always seemed like the main logical impasse for nuclear power is you're dealing with something that is so deadly and you can't contain it, and there's no way to store the waste that's safe.
That's right, and that, you know, when everybody keeps saying, well, we need nuclear power plants, well, where are you going to put the waste? Vermont Yankee is running out of space. They're now, you know, the swimming pools with the radioactive rods are, I think, full. Now they're using dry cask storage, and they dropped one. I mean, I don't know how this is going to be contained. And then when you talk about decommissioning a nuclear power plant, I think that Vermont Yankee has somewhere around 300 some million dollars ready to decommission it, but it'll cost somewhere around $875 million to actually do the work. So how are these plants going to be decommissioned? I simply don't know.
But there'll be less waste to decommission if it's shut down now.
Yes.
Now, we only have about 8 minutes left, and I guess on a personal level, I'd just like to know, you've been working on this for a long time, and I find the subject depressing, but interesting, because it's what's going on in our lifetime, and it's a problem that I think needs to be tackled sooner rather than later. But I was wondering, how do you keep your head above the waters of depression as you work on these issues?
It's very difficult. Both of my parents, neither of whom smoked or drank, died of cancer, but both of them were exposed to carcinogens. My granddaughter at age 3.5 had a malignant brain tumor.
Mm.
She didn't smoke or drink. I mean, these issues are very difficult to deal with, and I think that prevention is the only thing we can do. And I try. It's very difficult. But I hope that there will be more people interested in preventing illness rather than the enormous cost, not only financial cost, but the human toll that treatment of cancer and other diseases takes. I hope that more people will join this, and I applaud you for your program, for taking, you know, time to talk to people like me, that we hopefully can prevent some of these illnesses.
Now, if you listen to the major media, you're describing, I think, essentially saying that there's more cancer now than there used to be. And if you listen to the major media, they're always saying that we've just about won the war on cancer.
Not even slightly. I mean, 40 years ago, breast cancer incidence was about 1 in 20. Now it's 1 in 8 women. We have not even... There's far more illness occurring now than there was 40 years ago.
So is that just PR coming out of the National Cancer Institute and the American Cancer Society?
And the industry that supports it. I mean, there's a lot of money to be made if you're going to want to do genetic tests on people. There's a tremendous amount of money to be made, and there's a tremendous amount of money to be made in treatment of illnesses. But there's practically no money to be made in prevention.
I see. So it's basically... they're basically ambulance chasing and making money off of other people's suffering.
I couldn't agree with you more.
Now, in the few minutes we have left, maybe we could talk a little bit about what do you think people should be aware of, and who are the groups if people wanted to get involved in starting to prevent disease by stopping pollution. Just generally, what would you recommend people do?
Be questioning when you read that when you read something saying, well, this is perfectly safe or this kind of stuff, be aware and question this. Is this really true? You know, can we really trust this source and find out who's paying the bill? In the back of my book, I list a number of organizations that are involved in prevention of cancer and the nuclear issues, the chemical issues, also a number of books that are available. People need to read and keep up to date on what's going on and question some of these statements that people are making, that there's no harm from this or that.
So you're just basically telling people to be skeptical citizens?
Skeptical citizens? And educated citizens and aware, yes.
And Is there any way you can think of, as an internist, that people can avoid, if they are exposed to pollutants, avoid damage?
Well, I tell people, if you read the label on every single food that you buy,
mm-hmm.
if you can't pronounce the chemical that's listed on a package of whatever, don't eat it.
Practical advice.
In other words, try as best you can to eat as simply as you can from sources that you know as best you can to be safe.
And nutritionally, do you have any recommendations as an internist? Have you...
Lots of fruits and vegetables and whole grains, yes.
Mm-hmm. So,
and as little in the way of meat as possible, particularly from animals that may be raised on hormones.
So you might be all with locally raised animals if they're not downwind of a nuclear power
that's
plant.
Better if you know who's raising it.
Yeah.
And where you are, I looked up your town and on the map, and where you are, you may have sources of decent food there.
Hmm. Well, I'd like to talk to you more about your Chernobyl book when it comes out. That's this fall?
Yes, I think it'll be out in September, I hope.
And do you have a different publisher than the one that canceled your recent book?
Oh, yes. The Chernobyl book will be out, I'm hoping, and yes, I would like to work on, have a discussion on that when it comes out, please.
Okay. Well, we'll have a talk about that then, and I have... one more question that I meant to ask earlier that I didn't get to, and where does depleted uranium fit in to the spectrum of danger from radiation?
Well, depleted uranium is what's left over when they take out the more powerful uranium-235 to make bombs and things like that. So you have left with 238, and it itself is an alpha emitter, but the biggest problem with depleted uranium is that it's used in artillery shells.
Right.
And has been used in Iraq and Afghanistan and other places. And when these shells explode, the uranium is pyrolyzed and goes into the air, and there's tremendous exposure to inhalation to the civilian and military population, you know, where these bombs are used.
So
these shells are used.
So we're basically putting our own men and the citizens at risk.
Yes.
With this, okay. All right. Well, I wanted to know the answer to that. I know I've been told the opposite of that by our senators and congressmen. They've been told that it causes no harm by the military, so they weren't concerned with it. All right, well, Dr. Janet Sherman, thank you so much for coming on today. Your book, Life's Delicate Balance, Causes and Prevention of Breast Cancer and Chemical Exposure and Disease, is available at her website, janetsherman.com. An excellent book. Thank you very much for writing it and for being on today and for your life's work.
Thank you so much. You're a good interviewer. I appreciate it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, we'll talk again, I hope, soon.
Thank you.
All right. Yeah, bye-bye for now. All right, that was Dr. Janet Sherman, an internist and a longtime researcher. Worked for the government, U.S. Naval Research Laboratory at Hunters Point in San Francisco, and a number of other important institutions. And you've been listening to Politics and Science with host John Barkhausen. If you have any questions for Politics and Science, you can direct them by email to politicsandscience@madriver.com. That's politics. politicsandscience@madriver.com. Politics and Science can be heard weekly on WMRW LP Warren 95.1 FM, airing on Mondays at 5 p.m. And in the Bellows Falls area, can be heard on Wool LP Bellows Falls at 101.1 FM, airing from 3 to 4 p.m. on Sundays and from 9 to 10 a.m. on Mondays. Politics and Science presents the viewpoints of its participants and does not necessarily reflect the viewpoints of any other person or organization.